Public opinion research is essential for public policymakers to understand how to move forward.
I'm Eric Wilson, managing partner of Startup Caucus, an investment fund and incubator for Republican campaign technology. Welcome to the Business of Politics show. On this podcast, we bring you into conversation with the entrepreneurs who build best-in-class political businesses, the funders who provide the capital, and the operatives who put it all together to win campaigns. We're joined today by David Winston, one of the most trusted names in political polling. He's the president of the Winston Group, a Washington, D.C.-based strategic planning and survey research firm. David has served as a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for the last decade. I'm excited to have him on today because David has a unique perspective on the history of polling, how it's used in campaigns, and translating survey insights into strategy. Looking forward to a great conversation today. David, the polling industry has taken some hits in terms of credibility over the last few cycles. Can you give us a quick history lesson of how shifts in technology and maybe even media have changed the way polling works?
What you're watching is a transition in terms of the methodology. If you go back to the 1980s, 1990s, polling was basically done through landlines. And landlines, you knew where the person was. They were in the house. They were likely standing next to a phone and weren't wandering too far away from it because they were stuck with a cord. Okay. With a cell phone, you don't know if you've got somebody in a restaurant, driving a car, just walking around, actually at home, maybe at work. So there's just a whole different variation of how that person is interacting with that call. And so what does that mean? Then you get to the element, because they're on a cell phone, they could be distracted. Are you in fact getting the sort of information you think you're getting? And by the way, the other problem with cell phones is they're significantly more expensive than landlines. So you've seen the cost go up. And now you've seen this transition to doing a lot of online polling, where in fact people can go at their own pace and they're obviously engaged with the questionnaire. But what you're getting is not a random sample anymore. You're getting a very specific selected group of people. Not selected, but you're getting a group of people, and it's non-random. And as a result of that, what you're watching is the process of firms collecting public opinion, having to have an understanding of what they should expect and waiting to it. The technical term is multiple regression with post-stratification, which basically says you collect enough of a group, that subgroup, that in fact you're confident it represents that subgroup, and then you proportionally figure out what size that particular group makes up of the overall electorate.
Polling is getting more expensive. What is driving that beyond just the cell phones?
Well, let me do the cell phones and landlines first, and then we'll get into the other piece. Cell phones, there was a law passed that basically prior to this, landlines, you could use a system called CADI, which is computer assisted dialing. And so what would happen is the computer would dial like 8 numbers, basically at the same time, whichever one picked up first, then the person would actually conduct the interview with that. You can't do that with cell phones. And so therefore the cost per call goes up significantly because it just takes a lot more. It takes a lot more calls to in fact generate the same amount of interviews. So that was the challenge there. And there've been some efforts to try to allow CADI to be used for cell phones. And so far that has not occurred. When you're getting to, again, doing online surveys where again, you're sort of going to a pool that whoever you're using to collect online information from, there's a lot of data that is captured in terms of those individuals. And so what you're looking at is in many cases, when you're going to an entity and you're saying, here's the universe I want, you're paying a different cost. You're paying to get people that will effectively give you enough sample size for all your subgroups that in fact you can do your own weighting. And again, that post-stratification, that just costs money. And so what you're seeing is the cost here, at least online, being on the data development side so that you've got quality individuals you're talking to and you understand a bit about them versus, and there's just additional costs there. Having said that, I think one of the things that you're seeing as people move to online is there's a slew of application of methodologies that create significant differences. So, for example, one of the things that you saw in terms of the last election was just this really significant range of, for example, what people were expecting in terms of party identification, in terms of the overall electorate. You had some situations where some surveys had party identification favoring Democrats by 10. Obviously, that's going to create a different result than if party identification had been even. And so part of the challenge as you're going through the process of, again, doing this post-stratification to try to get the demographics set up, that's obviously a key element to what your final result's going to be. And that just takes a lot of hard work, research, thinking through, and getting the equation right. The other element that I think is occurring in terms of online survey research is some of the ways you can capture data are much more robust than when you were doing it over the phone. Mm-hmm. And so there are a whole bunch of statistical tools that are potentially more available and are more robust given that particular data collection. So what you're seeing is the opportunity here for really doing some more in-depth review of the data set that you have, as opposed to just simply cross tabs and aggregate. So you can get into regression, you can get into classification in terms of doing a variety of k-means analysis, things like that. And so that's very labor intensive, but potentially the quality of what you're getting in terms of analysis is significantly improved. As a result of that, the costs go up, but you may see skyrocketing costs. I don't see that. I don't think it's going up as quickly as you're defining it. But having said that, there's still a lot more robust things that individuals can do that you're seeing reflected in that.
Got it. And I think one of the other challenges comes down to this idea of representative samples that I want to dig into for just a minute. And so I think for our listeners to understand, the foundational concept of polling and the practice thereof is representative samples, that if I ask 100 people a question, I can reasonably extrapolate that to 100,000 or 10,000 people. And so that was pretty clear cut 30 years ago when you and I would have read the same newspaper, or watched the same TV shows. But the media diet today is completely unique to each viewer. It's a thumbprint. Are representative samples dead, or is it still possible to get some approximation of them?
There's two levels to your question here. Let me answer the one that I think you're initially going to. And that is, if I just randomly select 1,000 people, what's the likelihood that that's going to effectively represent the country? I think that's becoming more challenging on a daily basis. And I think in many cases, I'm not sure that that's doable. Again, the response rates are incredibly low, which is why what you're now seeing at this point is, again, as I was describing before, and there's a technical term to it, it's called non-probability sampling.
Right.
Okay. What non-probability sampling is, and this is where I think, yes, you can get to that, is if I have large enough subgroups, key subgroups, that I believe that the behavior of that subgroup is effectively reflected in that. And so the goal of the sampling is to get large enough groups so that, in fact, I've got that confidence level. Then it comes back to my post-stratification in terms of how I weight it. What do I think it is in terms of age, gender? In my case, I use party identification and ideology as well, looking at, again, sort of a Bayesian dynamic of looking at prior exit polls over the years and trying to extrapolate from that and sort of a prediction of where the post result is going to be and looking at that. Having said that, what you're also hearing is that there are a lot of different ways to approach that. And I think that's a challenge to anybody looking to go out and engage a firm. It's a lot different than just simply, here's somebody who can do a phone sample. So to your point, if I were just going to do 1,000 random sample, I think that's a real challenge to meet the goal of it reflecting the population as a whole. If you're doing a non-probability sample and you've got someone who's weighting based on census data, a variety of all sorts of different, you know, looking at the voter file and within the state, what percentage of the voter files, if you've got party ID or party registration, what percentage is Republican, Democrat? Gee, you can look at what the actual turnouts were to sort of work through that process. But notice what I just described is a lot of work prior to, and that's where some of the cost is.
Yeah. And so the idea is that even though individuals within those groups are going to have different media mixes and, you know, they listen to different podcasts or have different social media algorithm feeds, the contours of their behavior when it comes to, let's say, a political question is going to be similar enough.
On an individual one-on-one basis, you're going to see differences. But when you aggregate up and you've got 150 people, 250 people in terms of a subgroup responding, you can feel a little more certain that, in fact, you're getting a reasonable representation of that group. To your point, if you had, however, six samples of a particular group, obviously then the variance is huge. And that's part of the challenge. And one of the things when you're talking about cost, one of the things that I think is needed is that you just have to deal with larger sample sizes now at this point. Trying to do, for me, even, you know, 600 to 800, you know, again, you're looking at some of these subgroups and it gets pretty challenging in terms of looking at those and, you know, thinking of potentially 1,000 being a minimum here. And growing it from there. The other thing too, and again, you're getting into a variety of ways in terms of which people get information. I think part of the challenge that you get into as you look at that aspect of it, is one of the elements that in terms of the way I look at individuals is not as you've got physical attributes, but we're now getting to the point where we can sort of begin to understand to your point earlier, of what belief systems do these individuals carry? And so you can have people who have similar demographic characteristics, but dramatically different belief systems. And what you're seeing is a sophistication in terms of trying to be able to put those two together. Everybody has biases, and that's not necessarily negative. I mean, it's just how, you know, as you learn things, do things, you develop a point of view. And part of the challenge here is making sure as you're looking at this, that you not only simply understand, for example, the demographic of age, but the demographic of belief systems that potentially exist within that. Let me, if I may, I'll give you a good example. As we are in this debate about immigration, the fundamental belief system conflict that has emerged here is we're a country of laws or a country of immigrants. What's interesting is there's a significant number of people who actually think both those are important. And the problem that they're working through is how do they resolve how those two interact? Yet, to your point, the debate they're hearing is each side trying to prove that their particular value is more important. And yet the respondent or the individual, and many individuals are working through going, these are two important values to me. No, what I want to understand is how do you explain that to me? So one of the things that we're getting, particularly over time, is this better sense of not just simply demographics, but belief systems you're talking to. In a lot of cases, you're seeing, particularly with the online, some interesting longitudinal databases being put together, where not only do you get belief systems from of an individual, but you get them over time. So you can see, have they shifted? Has it remained the same? If they did shift, is there a pattern to that? Do you see other individuals with that same pattern? And that gives you a level of understanding of how belief systems interact with each other.
You're listening to the Business of Politics show. I'm speaking with David Winston about political polling, the challenges that the industry is facing, and what the way forward looks like. David, I want to shift now to the strategic side of polling. You were a part of the team behind the legendary Contract with America back in 1994. It was unique in that it was a clearly defined agenda that was positive, you know, what we're for instead of what we're against, and was unifying. Do you think with where politics is today, you know, driven by personalities and sort of an entertainment factor, do you think we'll ever see an effort like that again?
Well, you saw a bit of one, at least in terms of 2010, when Republicans won 63 seats, where the focus was not about being negative. It was defining what was the election about in that particular situation. Boehner was repeating the phrase, where are the jobs? Mm-hmm. Given the fact that unemployment was incredibly high, that was exactly the right question. And the connection that was being made there was, this is an individual who understands me in terms of what I think is the important dynamic facing the country. The challenge, and this is now part of the new media, is that in a lot of cases, well, first off, for a campaign, it's a lot easier to come up with something to attack the other person to actually come up with a compelling new idea. And so there's a default that tends to occur within campaigns to, well, we can do the attack stuff. And by the way, the attack stuff, it's not that what happens is people, it's not that they pay attention in terms of making a decision, but they pay attention in the sense of, you know, here's something sort of out there that's unusual and it sort of gets your attention. Therefore, the media likes that because they're just simply trying to get eyeballs, right? And mm-hmm. so somebody attacks somebody and it's like, oh, you know, I wonder what that's, and somebody watches it. Is that how people make ultimately make decisions? And a lot of cases, the answer to that is no. And I think we just saw that happen in the Virginia governor's race where McAuliffe was doing nothing but attacking Youngkin. Right. And even despite the state favoring Democrats by a significant margin, that clearly failed. And Youngkin in that particular case was able to come up with some compelling things. Example being, okay, people are struggling with inflation, so let's get rid of the grocery tax to at least help. But that's an example where you can see it occur. But I'm telling you, just broadly, the media itself prefers the negative side of it because that's how they think they get eyeballs. I think many media people, it's too hard to come up with a way to make an idea compelling. So it's a lot easier just simply to attack. And that's real challenge. And I'll give you an example of that, picking on the Republican side. In 2018, one of the big directions that Republican campaigns at the congressional level were saying, well, Nancy Pelosi is going to take away your tax cut, so vote Republican, right? And it was this whole thing about we're connecting Pelosi, she's going to take away the tax cut. The problem that existed is only about a third of the country actually thought they were getting a tax cut. And so the fundamental premise hadn't been established. And so as a result, all those ads were talking to about a third of the country, and quite frankly, most of those we already had. That's an example of where people and the challenge that's going to exist. And this is true for anybody sort of online dealing with this media, is how do you come up with compelling content that engages people in a positive way to take a step in any direction, buying a product, you know, going to a restaurant, I mean, name it. But how do you create that dynamic for somebody to do something positive? Inverse. If I told you, you know, hey, you know, you need to get rid of your car because your car's, you know, just in horrible shape, and you say, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, and he said, well, then get rid of it, right? And your response would be, well, I do need something else here to be able to like get to work and do basic things. And to some degree, you see lots of campaigns on both sides only do the first half of that argument and not really do the second.
It's a really interesting observation about the media's role in campaigns. And it makes me think that as we're going through new models of paying and funding for journalism or content more broadly, that might see a shift in our campaigns. Is that something that you see in the cards?
Let me go back to where I first experienced that to give you a sense. Many, many years ago, I was on a panel with a major TV news person, and I brought up, you know, look, you know, education is this incredibly important issue. And this is like 20 years ago. Education is this incredibly important issue. You know, I never see you covering it. And this person's response was, well, yeah, I mean, there's nothing really to cover. Where's the conflict? And so what campaigns or what candidates need to realize is that there's a different threshold for what engages an audience versus what they're trying to do. And we've had this discussion before. One of the biggest challenges in terms of all this media content and online content is not just simply putting information out there, but what's the persuasive value of it? Mm-hmm. And persuasion is particularly difficult because, I mean, ultimately at the end, you can convince them the other person is bad, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to agree with you or vote for you. And again, I will tell you, one of the things that was unfortunate in terms of the healthcare vote back in 2017 and the whole debate around that is we managed to take, Republicans managed to take what was a somewhat unpopular policy, the Obamacare. But by the end of the debate, because we didn't have anything to replace it, people were now slightly positive because at least it was something that was there that they could use. That's a challenge in terms of content moving forward, that how do campaigns, in fact, engage? And I have to say, Youngkin did a pretty good job here in terms of doing just that. Interesting thing about what he was able to accomplish. He, by the way, did, he won Republicans by 94, this is from the exit polls, in contrast to the 2020 presidential, where Trump won him by 81. So that was a 13-point improvement. If you take a look at conservatives, Trump won 61 by 67 amongst conservatives. Youngkin managed to get that all the way up to 86.
Wow.
And in fact, he reduced the negative margin. Biden won moderates by 34. And in this case, McAuliffe only won it by 21. So improved with moderates. So you watch somebody sort of across the board, given that positive view, in fact, build a majority coalition. Having said that, what you watch, again, let me go back to the immigration debate. It doesn't matter, you know, whether it's MSNBC or Fox, they're going to have the two people with those two points of view, i.e. country of immigrants, country of laws. And the whole point is to get them to argue with each other that their value is more important, because that's what gets eyeballs. And again, like I was saying before, that's not what the electorate wants to hear. What they want to hear is, I have these two values. How are you going to make them work together? You don't see that really happen, at least in terms of how news and the media is presenting that issue as an example.
So, David, I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball or long-range telescope now. And you've seen a lot of innovations in polling and survey research, leading many of them over the decades. And we're now coming into this era of really abundant data, artificial intelligence, computer modeling, all of the new things that we're seeing every day. What do you see the future of polling and survey research look like, and how does it fit into a big data world?
Well, first off, it is absolutely essential for public policymakers to have access to good quality survey research. I mean, because otherwise, I mean, how long does it take to go around and talk to 1,000 people in your district to understand exactly where are, or in your state, where exactly does an issue stand? And so there's a really important public policy role to be played here. And let me just stop for a second, just to sort of give a sense. I mean, in looking at what I was describing before in terms of this whole concept of post-stratification, and in terms of this, and in terms of the whole concept of non-probability sampling and what that means, if you do it right, and I was fortunate in terms of, in this last election, I was within a half a point of the actual presidential result and within 1 point of the congressional level result using that methodology. And I think part of what you're going to see longer term is people ultimately moving toward trying to get larger samples and getting the subgroups right, because public opinion research is essential for public policymakers to understand, in fact, how to move forward. One of the things, and I'm going to go way, way back to actually Ronald Reagan's pollster, whose construct of how we use public opinion was to understand, in fact, how to effectively engage the electorate and how do you move ideas forward, as opposed to just a simple binary concept of, is it person A or person B? And right. So, and he developed, and there are a lot of people who picked up after him. I pick on him because he kind of started that piece. But this gets back to what you led off with in terms of the whole idea of personalities are interesting, but ultimately people want to vote for an outcome or a direction that they think will move the country forward. And again, you know, going back to the debate that occurred in 2010 in terms of, was it about the jobs, where the jobs that Boehner did focused on, that in fact was the conversation that the electorate wanted to hear. And by the way, just to give you an example of just like how successful that was, Republicans in that election actually won women. And by the way, we got up to 38% of the Hispanic vote at that point, because that was an important issue that people wanted whoever it was who was going to govern to understand that that was the priority. And that's an example of how it works in terms of a public policy way. The challenge that you have at this point is many times you just see a complete disconnect between a political campaign and what the electorate is actually looking for. Having said that, this new way, this new construct of, with non-probability sampling, but just in terms of the robust data and information that you can get from using that methodology, I think is going to give public policymakers a much stronger ability to get to a conclusion that matters to the electorate, and I think ultimately will improve things. But we may have a couple of stops and starts on the way there.
So, David, you've had a very long and successful career and continue to be influential in the political space. What advice could you share with our listeners today who are trying to figure out how do they build staying power in this industry and maintain trust as candidates come and go and movements rise and fall?
Perhaps the toughest part is in this field, prepare yourself for what you're learning now could be obsolete in a year. And so how do you create a constant learning environment for yourself so that as things emerge, that you can be sort of recognizing them first, or at least recognizing them early and being able to implement them in such a way that they provide value to whoever you're dealing with, your clients, other individuals, and, you know, what's the value proposition of your knowledge? That's a really hard thing to do. In the sense of once you learn something and in theory you're the expert, to suddenly be told that actually your expert knowledge is now obsolete is not exactly a welcome thought, right? but having said that, it's this constant sense of learning and being able to engage in terms of that and express that and being willing to move beyond where you're at a particular point. But also with that, having the confidence isn't quite the right word. It's having the trust in terms of your own thought process, that as you look at difficult situations, that you can define a solution that in fact does provide value to your clients or the people that you're dealing with.
Thank you so much for that advice, and appreciate you making the time to chat with us today. I'll link to David's website in the show notes, and he always is putting out really good insights. So I recommend people who are trying to understand the public policy and political environment to check out David's work. Thank you for listening to our conversation. If you found this conversation interesting, I'd encourage you to share it with a colleague. Or if you're a longtime listener of the Business of Politics show and you haven't already done this, please go rate and review the podcast on Apple, because this helps with discovery. And the mission of Startup Caucus is bringing more innovators into our space. So we need them to hear this too. With that, we'll see you next time.